ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's been described as every marine scientist's Christmas. A milky cloud has blanketed parts of the Great Barrier Reef with the annual coral spawning spectacle. And this year's event is especially important for restoration after major events damaged the reef.
It was so dense in the water with larval spawn that you could barely see your hand in front of your face. So it was a really fantastic event. We managed to collect about 9 million larvae. They're currently sitting in our labs and growing up.
That story soon. And solar panels were a big casualty when giant hailstones fell in recent destructive thunderstorms in southeast Queensland. It's now prompting questions about national standards.
The conditions change, the standards change to meet those different conditions. So it's happened in cyclones, it's happened in storm surge.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, the Liberal Shadow Ministry has agreed to dump net zero by 2050 from the party's platform. The group agreed to scrap net zero from the Climate Change Act and repeal Labor's 2030 emissions reduction target, endorsing the view of yesterday's party room meeting. The Liberals will remain in the Paris Agreement, effectively mirroring the Nationals' position. And while the party would not actively strive for net zero, it was agreed that reaching it would be a welcome outcome. Our reporter Lisa Herbert has been following this story.
The Liberal Party has agreed to formally abandon its commitment to net zero emissions by 2050, a day after the majority of members came out in support of scrapping the climate target. Opposition leader Susan Lee.
Our emissions reduction goals will never come at the expense of Australian families, and this is the principle that will guide every decision we take. To keep faith with that commitment, the Liberal Party will remove a net zero target from our policy. And if elected, we will remove the 43% 2030 target and its net zero by 2050 target from the Climate Change Act. We remain committed to the Paris Agreement and to doing our fair share to reduce emissions. But we will do it in a way that protects households and budgets and keeps our economy strong.
When asked about how this policy shift will be received by city voters and electorates that the Liberal Party will be looking to win over, Susan Lee pointed to the cost of living.
But I know that people in the city are struggling with affordability of energy costs. I know that people who work in areas that are dependent on energy-intensive industries, whether it be heavy industry, which we no longer seem to have any more of in this country because of the government's policy, whether it be the prospective data centres or AI that all require intensive energy, or whether it be something that is a local small business that is manufacturing from aluminium that is about to close down when Alcoa closes down. These are highly relevant questions to people in the cities. And I talk about mums with kids who are struggling to pay the bills, and I meet them in the cities all the time.
Shadow Energy Minister Dan Tehan, who has been tasked with steering the party's emission policy development, said all natural resources, including coal, should be used to push down energy prices while ensuring Australia does its fair share to reduce emissions.
We will make sure that we have a technology agnostic approach. So when it comes to the capacity investment scheme, yes, we will support the state governments, Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland, who are already sweating their coal assets. So we will support them because we've got to make sure we keep capacity in the system. We will take a technology agnostic approach. So we will let the market determine how we go about that.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the policy shift meant that the Liberal Party did not believe in the science of climate change.
They're walking away from climate action because they fundamentally do not believe in the science in climate change. They're also walking away from reliable and affordable energy, renewables backed by storage and backed by gas for firming capacity. Australians cannot afford to keep paying the price of coalition infighting when it comes to climate policy and energy policy.
Nationals leader David Littleproud welcomed the news, arguing the move was not anti-climate science.
We believe in climate change. We believe that we need to do something about it. We believe that we should do our fair share. But we shouldn't streak ahead of the rest of the world, which is what this government wants to do, costing the Australian taxpayer $9 trillion, putting at risk Medicare and the NDIS, when there is a cheaper, better, fairer way to do that. And what we'll now do is sit down with our Liberal colleagues over the coming couple of days to get to a final position that I believe will give the Australian people an intelligent conversation, not one predicated on puerile politics of whether we believe in climate change or not. The science is settled. What isn't settled is the economics.
However, not everyone in the Liberal Party agrees with the decision to dump net zero by 2050. Senior moderates like Andrew Bragg and Tim Wilson have argued to keep the commitment. Liberal Senator Andrew McLaughlin says colleagues who think that scrapping net zero will be electorally advantageous are wrong and doesn't think he's alone in his views in the community.
You're wrong. What more can I say? I try to argue the case. I don't think I'm alone in the community, not only from a grassroots level, but also, for example, the National Farmers Federation, certain business councils. I mean, if you're going to argue that we're going to abandon net zero, you're going to be very alone in the community and also the business community.
Simon Woolwork farms at Corrigin, 220 kilometres east of Perth. He's the chair of Ag Zero, a movement formed by a group of WA workers to promote positive responses to climate change. He told reporter Kate Forrester this policy shift won't change much in the immediate term, and agriculture is already on the front foot when it comes to adopting renewables.
Firstly, the LNP is not in power, and I do wonder how this will resonate with many voters, particularly younger people, and what are their chances of getting back into power in the next election cycle or two. So we've got to keep that in perspective. It may be some time before they have the opportunity of changing this legislation.
So what you're saying there is basically it doesn't actually matter, really, because they have no power right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, and agriculture is to some extent getting on the front foot. Obviously, particularly in Western Australia, a majority export industry. We're, you know, increasingly aware of international measures around climate change and decarbonisation, and many farming businesses are preparing themselves for that. They're starting to take up carbon accounting and that sort of thing, and looking at ways of reducing our emissions.
Simon Woolwork admits that the dropping of net zero by the Liberal Party could erode confidence in the renewable sector.
What it does do is it erodes some confidence with investment in the likes of renewable energy and perhaps carbon farming and that sort of thing, which ultimately are a potential opportunity for agriculture. The idea that we have another source of income to diversify regional economies through renewable energy projects is a real positive, particularly when we're facing cost pressures and the direct impacts of climate change. We know it's getting drier and warmer in Western Australia, and it's going to be really useful to have other forms of income as such.
That's Corrigin farmer Simon Woolwork. Ending that report from Lisa Herbert.
ABC Australia Wide.
To WA now, where a state administrative tribunal into plans by mining billionaire Andrew Forrest to build an irrigation project along a river in the Pilbara has heard its final day of evidence. Mr. Forrest is seeking permission to build 10 weirs along the Ashburton River, which runs through his Mindaroo Station property. The plan to build the weirs was initially knocked back by the state government in 2017 because the river is a place of spiritual significance for the Thalangi traditional owners. Pilbara reporter Alastair Bates has been there at the tribunal and joins me in the studio. Al, what was said at the tribunal over the last couple of days?
So, Alex, yesterday was actually the last time the tribunal will hear from experts and lay witnesses in relation to this case, and that brings to a close what's ended up being 8 full days of hearings. Now, in that time, we've heard from a whole range of people, including an economist who told us about the possible downstream financial benefits of the WIRS project, a hydrogeologist who described the need for water in the Pilbara, staff as well from Andrew Forrest's family property, Mindaroo Station, and of course, Ballingee traditional owners. The proceedings over the last few days, however, really zeroed in on the anthropological significance of the Ashburton River, and the tribunal heard from two experts, a Dr. Edward McDonald, who commissioned a report on behalf of traditional owners, and Dr. Brendan Corrigan, who was brought on board by Andrew Forrest. Now, Dr. McDonald had already taken the witness box earlier this week. His questioning by Mr. Forrest's legal team was really intensive. It took practically a day and a half, and they really went after his credibility. Ken Pettit, SC, who was leading Mr. Forrest's lawyers, repeatedly tried to convey the point that Dr. McDonald was doing anything to cast the WIRS project in a less than favourable light and didn't apply the kind of analysis one would expect from an academic expert, in part because he was so closely connected to the opposition of the WIRS project. The anthropologist has been giving evidence against the WIRS since they were first proposed in 2017. Now, it should be said, Dr. McDonald very much rejected these claims before the tribunal and stood firmly behind his testimony and breadth of experience in the area. But perhaps the most dramatic moment happened yesterday when Andrew Forrest's lawyers played a video that they says shows a traditional owner being coached by an off-screen voice to describe the Ashburton River as a spiritual site. That interview was filmed in 2017 and was later included in a documentary that contributed to the WIRS project rejection by the state government. And the same interview was cited by Dr. McDonald's report to the tribunal more recently in 2025. Mr. Forrest's lawyers argued this showed some fundamental errors, and while Dr. McDonald conceded, it appeared the interviewee was being coached. He told the tribunal the person in question was very shy and likely needed the support off camera, and that the stories he shared were consistent with conversations they had had prior to that video being made. So the day really pivoted on the point of whether the whole of the Ashburton River should be considered a sacred site or only certain parts, and this is where Dr. McDonald and Dr. Corrigan diverged. That will be a key element of the tribunal's decision on whether to approve the WIRS this time around and any conditions they might attach to that decision.
Okay, and you've spoken with a traditional owner to hear her reaction to the hearing. What did she have to say?
That's right, Alex. So for all these sort of academic discussions, we've also heard directly from traditional owners themselves, the Ballingee people. Those who've spoken over the course of the last few days have described the Wanamakura, a spiritual water serpent who travels up and down the river, protecting the country and its inhabitants. The three Ballingee witnesses we've heard from, all members of the Hayes family from Onslow in the Pilbara, feared that this spirit would be angered by interfering further with the river. And they also raised concerns about what it would mean for accessing their traditional country. I spoke with Trudy Hayes following the tribunal. She told me that this rehearing, because remember, this is both parties' second time around in the State Administrative Tribunal, she said the rehearing had left her anxious for a place that's truly important to her. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
That's our sacred site because for us, the river gives us our life. Like I said in the courthouse, I lost my son and my healing, even though I work for the health department, I didn't go to social workers within the health department. I went back on country.
Trudy Hayes there. So, Alistair, where do we go from here?
Well, proceedings kind of came to an anticlimax yesterday as both legal teams conferred over dates for their closing arguments. So lawyers on both sides will need time to consider what was said before the tribunal and their opposite numbers arguments. That combined with scheduling conflicts and the availability of judge means those closing arguments will happen in February next year, at which point the judge is likely to reserve his decision for a later date. So even though the evidence is effectively wrapped up, you know, this battle is far from over, and that's something that's been echoed both by Trudy and the Forrest camp.
Our reporter in the Pilbara is Alistair Bates. Alistair, thanks so much for bringing us up to date here on Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Residents are still picking up the pieces after two consecutive supercell storms battered southeast Queensland earlier this month. Hailstones with a diameter of up to 9 centimetres fell on the Darling Downs, leaving a wake of destruction, especially to solar panels. It's got people wondering how they'll power on through summer. Grace Nakamura has more.
Prue and Jamie Rogers moved from Brisbane to a rural property on Queensland's Darling Downs last year to live the quiet life. But Mother Nature had other plans.
Literally the worst experience ever in my life. I have never seen hail so bad. Come back out to put towels over the car, as that's what you would do if you have hail, not expecting it to be the size that it was. And then I got bombarded with the hail on my back, on my head, and had to hide under the house until I could make refuge back into the inside. It was scary. It was very scary.
The Rogers rely entirely on their 21 solar panels to power their property, and the hail smashed every last panel. The damage to their place was immense.
Five cars are damaged, mainly glass and panel damage, tractor, fuel pods.
Solar.
Solar's completely gone. Yeah, and whatever damages to the roof.
And that's what I've heard around Pratton, is the fact that there is a lot that don't have insurance on their properties, which is very sad. We're one of them. It costs so much for insurance that you can't even insure your place to for these type of things.
Since those two destructive storms in early November, there have been 28,250 insurance claims lodged about the severe weather event in southeast Queensland. There's no breakdown on the number of claims that relate to solar panel damage, and there are more storms on the horizon.
So our general expectation is that over time, as the atmosphere gets warmer, we might get thunderstorms that are capable of producing larger hailstones.
Dr. Tim Rorpak is from the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response. He co-authored research this year that looked at how hail damage potential in major Australian cities might change in the future.
So in this work, we were using computer simulations over cities across Australia and the areas around them to try to see how many hail storms we got and any changes to the hailstone sizes and winds around the hail in the future scenarios that we were running. And what we found was that in some cities, such as Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne, we did see really significant increases in the future simulated hailstone sizes. In other places, like around Brisbane, we actually saw an increase in frequency in the hailstorms in the projected future, but not a significant change in the hailstone sizes.
But Dr. Rorpak says it's still possible for regions around Brisbane to experience large hail, like the 9 centimetre hail that fell in the Darling Downs on November 1st.
And we do also know that hail can really grow to those kind of extreme sizes. So anything above 5 centimetres in Australia, we call that giant hail. And yeah, 9 centimetre hail is really getting into some of the extreme sizes.
This modelling is based on global warming of 2.4 degrees, which experts say could happen by the end of this century. But Dr. Rorpak is an optimist.
You know, I like to remember that we are still in the driver's seat, really, when it comes to how much temperature change we produce in the world and with global warming, because we have the power to still change and reduce our emissions that really are the big control on that temperature change.
Right now, there are more than 4 million households and businesses in Australia with rooftop solar. That's millions of solar panels taking the brunt of the giant hail that's expected to keep falling in Australia. So is it time to change the national standard for solar panels? Adam Stingmore is the Chief Development Officer with Standards Australia, the body that adopts and develops the standards for almost all products in the country.
A solar panel on a roof, of course, has to deal with all sorts of weather, sun, wind, hail, rain, and they're made to standards that give them a design life in most part of between 20 and 25 years. So the international standard that we've adopted here in Australia says that for a minimum compliant product, it must withstand a 25 millimetre hailstone coming at a velocity that would match that of a hailstorm. The standard also allows for testing up to 75 millimetres for different sizes of hail. And there's a lot of products now coming onto the market that go above the minimum standard and provide more hail protection.
Changing the standards is a discussion to be had between governments, community, industry and Standards Australia, but it can be done.
This is quite common in the standard setting process, that as conditions change, the standards change to meet those different conditions. So it's happened in cyclones, it's happened in storm surge, and standards revisions generally run between 3 and 5 years at the international level, and very much based on data. So if the standards for solar panels are continuing to evolve for three things: first of all, safety; second of all, efficiency; and third of all, to make sure that they meet the requirements of the environments which are installed.
Back in Pratton, the Rogers have been able to negotiate a payment plan with their solar company to put new panels on their roof.
Otherwise, we would have had to have waited till May next year. That's how far they're booked out till, because we're off grid, so we would have had no power whatsoever till May next year.
While the storm has passed, for now, they'll be keeping one eye on the sky.
The whole reason we moved out here was to live a life of peace, which is funny because we haven't had it since we've been here.
Grace Nakamura with that report. And staying in Queensland, it's a summertime tradition for many Australian families, young and old, take a road trip to a quiet beachside town for a caravan holiday. But in one of Queensland's most popular destinations for grey nomads and young families, the threatened closure of a caravan park has led to a strong community backlash. Some experts say it throws a spotlight on changes happening around the country that may be impacting our caravan culture. James Taylor has the story.
We've been coming here for years now. The beach is lovely. It's the best beach along here. I just find it lovely park, a lovely park to visit. And I think it'd be a real shame if they closed it down.
Every summer for the past 8 years, Pamela Dibben has travelled with her husband from Victoria to Hervey Bay, 3 hours' drive north of Brisbane, to stay at the Torquay Caravan Park. But now the local council is considering whether to close the park, one of four council-run parks in the town, which means she might have to find somewhere else to stay.
I'm just so used to this park, and we just sort of feel like it's just the only place we'd go, so I don't think we'd probably come back to Hervey Bay.
In October last year, Fraser Coast Regional Council passed a unanimous motion to pause the $8 million redevelopment of Torquay Caravan Park. The council wanted to consider alternative uses for the site on the Hervey Bay foreshore, including opening it up to the public in the form of open parkland or a playground and recreational hub. Some of the councillors who tabled the motion thought the public would be supportive of having more access to the foreshore, but instead it sparked a strong community backlash from people opposing the closure of the caravan park.
I'm surprised by the anger. This issue has united our community like none other.
Former councillor Sue Brooks is organiser of the Save Our Torquay Caravan Park Community Action Group, which is marshalling the public's opposition to the closure of the park. A survey distributed by council asking the public to choose their preferred option for the park received more than 4,000 responses. Council said it was the largest response they've ever received to a community engagement process. 76% of the respondents said they wanted council to retain and upgrade the caravan park. Ms. Brooks says the opposition to closing the park is based on a mix of soft nostalgia and hard-nosed business interests.
To me, it's part of the heart and soul of Hervey Bay. I can't understand the logic. We have an esplanade with so much parkland and green space now. The input that we're getting from the community is that they never feel crowded at the parks. The businesses directly opposite the caravan park have loudly spoken out. They're very against it.
Fraser Coast Regional Council isn't alone in weighing up whether it is worth staying in the business of running caravan parks. In September, nearby North Burnett Regional Council said it will be relinquishing its ownership of four caravan parks, instead seeking to transfer ownership of the parks to private operators. A spokesperson said the decision was made to improve council's financial sustainability in the long term. In July, North Bennet Regional Council handed down a 25% rate increase, which it said was caused by spiralling costs for providing utilities and services. Dr. Rodney Caldicott, a tourism researcher from Southern Cross University, says many local councils are looking to offload caravan parks due to rising maintenance costs, which get passed on to ratepayers.
You can just about name any town in Australia because they were an asset that was built in the 70s. Some councils did spend money and try to keep up in the infrastructure, but others didn't. And so, you know, just get run down. So the local ratepayers saying, we've just got a 25% increase so that we can look after these Victorians to come up here in the winter and have a great time in the prime location. And I'm living out in the boondocks, you know, because I can't afford to live beside the coast. Get all that community feeling.
Michelle Weston is Chief Executive of Caravan Parks Association of Queensland. She says that of the scenarios offered by the two Queensland councils, North Bennet's attempt to retain the parks through private ownership is more common.
We do see adjustments to operating models, so it's not unusual for councils to switch between leasing their caravan parks out and having a management contract in place. It's a very, very rare circumstance indeed for a council to decide to shut their caravan park completely. I've been in the industry for nearly two decades and I've only seen it happen in one other occasion.
Back at her caravan, Pamela Dibben says in her experience, she's finding it harder and harder to find a place to stay in her annual pilgrimage up the coast.
A lot of parks are closing down sites and they're going towards the cabin style accommodation. There's a heck of a lot more caravans on the road. I just feel it really just shouldn't close. It'd be a travesty for everybody.
That's retiree Pamela Dibben ending that report from James Taylor. And finally here on Australia Wide. A milky cloud has blanketed parts of the Great Barrier Reef this week as the annual coral spawning spectacle took place. But research indicates only 1% of the trillions of larvae grow to become coral. For scientists, it's a time they rush to lend a helping hand. Cairns reporter Roseanne Maloney has more.
It's the annual Great Barrier Reef coral spawning event. But as the little coral sperm and eggs have been floating around, hoping for a chance at life, it's also the moment researchers have been trying to help more babies survive. The CSIRO and Southern Cross University researchers have a plan.
We've developed a technology called a larval seed box.
CSIRO lead researcher Dr. Christopher Doropoulos says the seed box project aims to increase the resettlement of coral spawn across wider areas where it's previously been low. After a successful trial last year at Lizard Island in northern parts of the reef, they've been back in the water again this year.
We've got some really positive results showing larval dispersal and settlement onto the reef at scales that haven't been demonstrated before. The first phase is this settlement, and so that's what we found 56 times improved abundances compared to a nearby control site where we didn't release our larvae.
The process sees teams scoop up nighttime spawn slicks from the water, grow larvae for several days, then load about 2 million into each clear box. Divers set the boxes on the seabed and open a base slider so larvae drift out naturally. The water is dyed pink and the larvae are dyed blue, so it's a colourful spectacle in the water on release.
And the beauty of this is that we can deploy many of these units across the reef, but the ultimate goal is to produce something that can be used by local communities, but to really see effective restoration, it would be up to about 4 to 5 years on the Great Barrier Reef.
40 kilometres off Cairns on Moore Reef, another team, alongside University of Technology Sydney researcher Jennifer Matthews, is focused on increasing survival before settlement.
So we developed a coral baby food.
As the tiny sperm and eggs hit the water, they were instantly on the job.
Last night was the big spawning event. It was so dense in the water with larval spawn that you could barely see your hand in front of your face. So it was a really fantastic event. We managed to collect about 9 million larvae. They're currently sitting in our labs and growing up.
The team feed larvae, settle them on tiles, then return those tiles to marked plots on the reef.
So corals, just like you and I, they require optimal nutrition to thrive and survive. And that's no more important than during vulnerable life stages like when they're larvae. We thought, what if we could actually feed them to provide them with that boost of nutrition to survive that early life stage? And so we tried it in the lab and we found that we could double the survival rate.
2 years ago, the project's first trial was unable to produce results after Cyclone Jasper ripped through the samples.
This is the first time that it's going to be seen all the way through to the 6 month survival rate.
Great Barrier Reef Foundation Managing Director Anna Marsden says having a range of projects targeting different stages of coral development is the best way to achieve results.
You would absolutely say that this time of year is every marine scientist's Christmas.
She says it's been a rough couple of years for the reef following Cyclone Jasper, bleaching, floods, water quality issues and crown of thorns starfish.
Certainly we're having some really tough summers, which shows up with warming water, which triggers marine heat waves and coral bleaching. So coral spawning is the perfect time of year to aid that recovery and ideally fast track it so that the corals over the next year then grow and get stronger and we can keep our reef thriving.
An important time to lend the world's largest coral reef system a helping hand.
It's a really important year to help make sure that every spawning event is as productive and successful as possible. So it's a little bit about science and conservation, giving Mother Nature an extra hand.
Roseanne Maloney with that story. And that is Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.